You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Child Safety on the Web 2.0, Who Should Protect Our Kids? Tim Lorden, moderator, Internet Education Foundation. Other panelists include Ann Collier, blogsafety.com, Chuck Cawson, Microsoft, Mark McCarthy, Visa, Margaret Moran, member of the UK Parliament, and Adam Thierer, Progress and Freedom Foundation. Due to technical problems, the first few minutes of this discussion were not recorded.
Filtering, and if they have better mechanisms of filtering than those that were available at the time at which I introduced the bill, that's all well and good.
Right.
There is no restriction on it. And I have to say as well that there has been a lively debate, and I guess it's the sort of debate that's happening here, as to whether we should extend the list to, for example, include images of violent pornography, violent adult pornography. Let me make it clear, I am clear, and I work with the Home Office Task Force, which is made up of politicians, of children's charities, of internet service providers, and we work collaboratively on these issues. And we are all very clear that we are dealing, in the issue of child abuse, we are dealing with a crime. Violent pornography may be untenable, not attractive, it may be, but it is not a crime.
Well,
and therefore we have to delineate where we can draw that line and what we expect of ISPs.
And here in the United States, let me just say our experience with regard to drawing that line is that the line is a lot less clear because of our First Amendment. It's very, very difficult to have government prohibit certain types of speech. Obviously, to the extent that violent pornography is violent and pornographic, it could be obscene, which is illegal here in the United States. Child pornography is illegal here in the United States. But we started out the approach. There was a test case for a similar type system in Pennsylvania. The state of Pennsylvania passed a law that would require ISPs to kind of filter out child pornography sites, which again are illegal. Unfortunately, the technology employed was pretty imprecise, and they ended up blocking huge swaths of internet content. To block out 350 known child pornography sites, they ended up blocking close to a million different websites, some of which were like the Susquehanna Bowling League Community Center and things like that. So that's untenable from our First Amendment perspective. And I'd like to ask some of the panelists, like Adam and others, how these things, can we import these, or is there trouble with regard to the First Amendment?
Well, I think we need to take one step back and ask ourselves all the efforts that are underway, and it's tough to argue against any of them, including things like the Pennsylvania law, even though there was an overbreadth issue there from a First Amendment perspective. But things like what Visa is doing in the financial community, things like CleanFeed, these are all very important efforts. But we spend a lot of time attempting to trace and identify where child pornography might be on the Internet. But we don't spend much time, at least not in this country from my experience and study of this, thinking about what we're going to do after we find it. And I want to point out what I think is the most disturbing statistic, and every time I speak, Tim gets sick of me using this statistic, but I'm going to use it again because it's so important. But the Department of Justice has studied how much time we actually put behind the bad guys behind bars for these crimes against children. And the numbers are startling. According to the Department of Justice, of a big survey they did on child molestation, the average sentence imposed on child molesters in this country is approximately 7 years, and on average they were released after just serving 3 of those 7 years. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that there's a lot of talk about market failure and about the problems of the Internet and about child pornography online. These are all valid concerns. But when we're only putting people who viciously and violently hurt our children behind bars for just 7 years and letting them out after 3, that's a government failure. That's not market failure. So we have to ask ourselves, are the penalties stiff enough for people we've already caught or we find through the types of services we're talking about here? Because recidivism is high, and we should be putting them behind bars for a lot longer. As the father of 2 young children, I cringe at the thought of someone hurting my children these ways, but I don't want to necessarily talk about Internet regulation without first talking about the penalties for child molestation and abuse, because this has always been a problem, but we've never adequately addressed it. And the Internet is not the core of this problem. It's just part of it.
Okay, well, let me ask, just go to Ann and Chuck with regard to the technology solutions, and just our kind of our last point on child pornography, and then we'll move on. And if I could ask you to move the microphones very close to your mouth so that the folks in the audience can hear. And Chuck, what technologically, you know, how can we address this problem, or is it, you know, or is it more of just putting these guys behind bars forever?
I think Chuck should start. He's got the big news this week.
And you're most gracious, I'm going to get Elvis close to the microphone here so that everyone can hear. On technology and child porn, let me say a couple of things. One is, I think on the list of URLs that the IWF creates, an URL is a uniform resource locator. It's an address where web content is found. On that list, we have thought through, and the technologists tell me exactly what happened in the Pennsylvania case is true, that at an ISP level, some of that overblocking is going to happen. But one thing that can be done, and which Microsoft has done, is you can take that list and not include it in a search index, so that at that point you're not blocking access to any other websites, but you are restricting the extent to which others might be able to locate those particular web addresses. Our real focus, I think, on technology is twofold. Well, one, and we'll get to this in the other sections, as Tim mentioned, we have parental controls in the new Windows Vista operating system that is out this week. And that's very important part of our efforts. But on the child pornography content, there's really three things worth noting. One is that we partner with law enforcement very closely on this. Considering this is criminal content, considering that, as others have said, this is a problem that requires cooperation amongst a lot of different parties, and that there is a very specific role for law enforcement in prosecuting and investigating crimes, and a supportive role to be played by technology companies. We partner with law enforcement. We've worked with the International Missing and Exploited Children Center to create model legislation, to conduct training for law enforcement officers who can get support from Microsoft in forensic investigative techniques so they can better understand how to extract evidence from computers. We've trained probably close to 1,900 officers in 20 separate trainings. We work very closely with others here in the United States, other internet companies, and something called the Technology Coalition, which is working with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to investigate ways that you can better share information about known child pornography images that have been found, to give them a hash value or a locator so that they can be tracked more effectively and used more effectively in investigations. And then lastly, we've worked with the Canadian police to develop a system called CETS, Child Exploitation Tracking System, which is a tool really designed by law enforcement, but with some technology support and financial support from Microsoft, that enables law enforcement to better share investigative information across jurisdictions. So that's really the main focus of our technology.
Well, before we move off of the subject, one final point from Ms. Moran.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I accept the point that my colleague here is making about sentencing. There is a need to ensure that we have effective sentencing, but I think it's all about prevention. And as far as the UK is concerned, what we have done is worked with NGOs, with industry, to develop the protocols, and it has been incredibly effective. As of this year, the number of abuse sites in the UK has dropped over 15% to less than 0.1%, all achieved within a year without legislation. We were in a situation where we were getting 70,000 images of child abuse every week. That's the scale of the problem. So we have to deal with not just the sites themselves and the content and what's on them, but we also have to deal with demand. And we've also learnt, and we have set up CEOP, the Child Protection Agency, which is bringing together all the law enforcement and industry and child NGOs. And what we've discovered there through the work that they've done in investigation is that those people who are viewing these sites are also potentially, proportionately, much more likely to be abusers in the real world. Right. So don't accept that the virtual world is any less dangerous than the real world. So we have to look at it in a holistic way, but also in terms of partnership and protocol, rather than seeing it simply as a law enforcement agency issue.
Let me move on to the other part of the issue, which is unwanted contact, whether it be by predators or otherwise. And I think that's a lot of angst in America right now on children using the internet in a variety of new and unexpected ways. And there seems to be a lot of angst with parents and policymakers about this particular issue. I imagine it's not that much different than when, you know, 10 years ago, 12 years ago, kids were first starting to use the internet, period. But we're in this new paradigm, and we're halfway through this panel, and we haven't even defined what Web 2.0 is. And I can think of no one better suited to kind of talk about what youth are doing online than Ann Collier, who kind of is a mom of youth and also writes about it daily and weekly. So, Ann, can you just kind of give us a sense of what is Web 2.0? How are teens and children using the internet in ways that we would never have imagined even 5 years ago?
Well, I think a lot of people sort of roll their eyeballs when they hear the term Web 2.0. It's sort of become a cliche. But as far as youth is concerned, it is very much a reality. It is not a cliche. They are the drivers of Web 2.0. And what it is simply, you know, this user-driven web is all about not just social networking, but creative networking and social producing. It's a kind of collective self-expression. And, you know, we had a lot of discussion this morning about broadband. And, you know, broadband is what enables this incredibly creative space for young people. And we have to kind of rethink what it means it in terms of the family computer. The internet is so much more mobile now. It can be accessed on so many different kinds of devices that, you know, it is just awesome that we're moving parental controls to the operating system level. That's a very important thing because it simplifies the whole process for parents and makes it much more accessible and hard, you know, much easier to learn. So, you know, that's really great. But think about it, you know, that operating system in a PC, you know, is no longer just plugged into a wall that the entire family accesses from a high traffic place in the house. And so this very mobile internet is requiring a much bigger toolbox. We're going to need to expand our education for parents, or we're going to need to expand the number of tools, and we already are. We heard a lot of news this past week about what MySpace is doing in terms of a parental notification piece of software, very simple piece of software that actually sort of moves with kids' access of MySpace. We've heard about some new legislation being introduced that will actually enable social networking sites to block internet predators who are convicted predators. Now we have to kind of work on those who are not yet convicted. But the toolbox is expanding, and all of these tools are really vital and important, and we need to help educate parents on how to use them.
Well, with regard, my question is this Web 2.0, is it something new? Is it something that is scarier? Are kids in more danger than they were before? Or is it just a matter of that parents need to just get acclimated and talk with their kids? I meant to start off this panel with a quote from Dick Thornburg, who is the former Reagan Attorney General. He had written at the National Academy of Sciences a committee report on the issue of youth pornography and the internet. And he had this phenomenal quote where he said, with regard to parenting children online is like swimming pools. You can put fences around them, you can put locks around them, the swimming pools, but the best way to keep your kids from drowning is to teach them how to swim. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the most profound statement on the subject that I have ever heard, and it comes from Dick Thornburg. What should we do? What should we be talking to our kids about with regard to Web 2.0 and social networking?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think we have to kind of move beyond the static safety tips, and we need to realize that for young people, there really is very little distinction between online and offline. It's just their social lives. And so applying, you know, online safety as a term is almost becoming obsolete, because in their world, it's kind of just safe, intelligent use. Or safe, intelligent socializing online and offline, really. And that's what we need to, you know, we ask them questions like, okay, who's going to the party? Whose house is it at? Who's driving home? Well, who's on your friends list? Who are you communicating with online? Who's on your instant messaging buddy list? And get in their faces more, just sort of transferring our good old parental skills into cyberspace more, as we think of it.
Let me just jump in there. I think Ann's hit on a very important point. One that we have taken on board from child safety experts when we designed the parental controls in Windows Vista, and also a free downloadable parental control tool called Windows Live OneCare Family Safety Settings. And both these tools are designed to drive conversations between kids and parents. So, for example, the Windows Vista parental controls creates an ability for a parent to set up a child user account and receive reports about what happens on the computer in that account. To monitor what applications or what games or what websites are being visited. But we very explicitly made this overt so that it's completely upfront that this account is being monitored. And the reports go to the parent. The parent can customize the settings. The parent gets tools so that they can manage the environment. We're not trying to create a PC environment that manages the environment for the kids, like, as Tim said, putting a fence around the pool, but to drive a conversation between parents and kids.
Let me go to Margaret, then to Adam. And Adam, if you could pull the microphone a little closer.
I think that we're all being terribly naive if we think that static, our computers are safe. We know that they're not safe. And I recently had a conversation in the UK with our Minister, Secretary of State for Education, in which I drew to his attention various websites that children, young people, have developed to bust through the firewalls of education sites. And I can quote you a few of them. I probably won't thank people for doing it, but I'll save those for other people for later. Young people are very inventive, and we have to use the innovation in the technology to get ahead of them. I think industry has a real responsibility and a real opportunity here. It's not just about good CSR, but you're developing the leading edge technology to be able to anticipate what some of these young people are doing. Whatever firewall we put up, these are sites that are being used in our classrooms that are supposed to be firewalled and protecting our children. Whatever firewall we put up, those young people will be anticipating it and busting it. That's what they think, you know, is great fun. So the mobile world, the static world, it doesn't make any difference. It just means that we have to work together with leading edge industry and think about where some of this social networking is really advancing forward and really be out there before the kids can get to it.
Well, Tim, you stole some of my thunder by talking about the Thornburg Commission report, because not only do I usually quote from it, but I bring the book along. And this National Research Council report remains the absolute best thing ever written in this country or any other, I believe, on the question of youth and Internet safety. And that compelling metaphor that the Thornburg Commission used about teaching kids to swim is really all about education and media literacy, of which there are several chapters in the book. And we really have failed in a big way in this country to think enough about media literacy at all levels of education. Recently, the state of Virginia came out with what I believe is model legislation to inject more media literacy and online child safety lessons into every curriculum and every level of the education process that should serve as model legislation for every state in the United States. And our federal government needs to do more. We're woefully behind in terms of education at that level through either the Department of Education, the FTC, or other areas. We have an OnGuard online website at the FTC and a few other efforts here and there, terribly uncoordinated, no serious effort along the lines of something like Smokey the Bear for forest fire prevention or Hoot the Owl for stopping littering. We need massive consumer parental and child education programs in this country. We don't have them. And we're not teaching kids how to swim in these new media waters. We need to find teachable moments at every level of education, in schools and libraries, everywhere else. When DARE walks into our classrooms to talk about drug concerns, they should talk about internet safety concerns.
Just yesterday, a teacher blogged, a tech educator blogged in techlearning.com about the need to bring ethics back into elementary education. Not just teaching online citizenship and netizenship, but teaching just good old basic citizenship. Everything we've talked about today in terms of respecting copyrights, that goes to cut and paste plagiarism. We need to think about the kinds of sourcing we're using in our school research, and we need to think about how we're using those sources and the ethics involved, and as well as how we're treating each other online and offline. These all can be taught at the elementary level and in the home.
Well, let me play devil's advocate, because we just commissioned for this particular conference some Zogby polling data, and we asked questions about at what age group should children be allowed to have email, web surfing, and engage in social networking sites. And across the demographics, it seemed that the older folks thought it was appropriate for them to have access to these things earlier and at younger ages. And the 18 to 24-year-olds had much higher. They were more conservative with regard to at what point teens should be able to allowed to have, or teens should have social networking sites, or children should have email. And that was an interesting disconnect for us. We thought it would be the other way around, where older folks would be more conservative and say never, and younger folks would say, well, it's not a big deal. How do you square that with regard to some of the proposals that we have on the Hill and elsewhere, that maybe teens shouldn't be allowed on certain sites or certain places?
Well, for good or bad, I think young people know what's going on better than older people on the social sites. And I think most of them realize that at the teenage level, what's really going on for the most part is just socializing with your peers at school. And then, there are kids who are at greater risk offline who are also more at risk online. And our education has to be.
Who are the greater risk? Is there a class of children that are at risk generally?
Well, we know that what a lot of young people do when they do this creative networking and design their profiles and their blogs is they're seeking validation. That's what psychologists tell us. And if they're not getting enough validation at home in sort of the normal way, they're going to seek it in the wrong kind of ways online. And that's, a lot of our thinking needs to be going more toward incorporating the experience of experts in at-risk teen behavior, pediatricians and child development experts, because these young people are, finding reinforcement for eating disorders and substance abuse and, self-mutilation and sexual exploration, and safety tips at home and internet use policies aren't reaching these more non-compliant, more risk-taking kids.
Well, in that regard, somebody had pointed out to me a 2004 study from the University of New Hampshire's Internet Crimes Against Children Research Center, which does some of the most remarkable research in the field with regard to child safety online, next to Pew Internet American Life Project, Amanda Lenhart. But they found this strange statistic where they looked at incidences of online predation in children that are victims, and they looked at the research and what happened with that, and they found that overwhelmingly, like 95% of these teens or these children that were victims online from online predators knew well before they ever met this predator, almost off the bat, they were an adult. They actually knew they were communicating with an adult, which is remarkable to me. And also, almost in all cases, they knew that the adult wanted sex from them. So
yeah,
is this the subset of at-risk children you're talking about?
Yeah, right. That's what the Crimes Against Children Research Center. It actually was a 2004 study, and it was a study of actual online sexual exploitation cases. And they found that the perpetrators were not deceiving either about their age, the huge age difference. Most of them were in their 40s, and they weren't being deceptive about their sexual intentions. So these are kids who, as Dana Boyd actually points out, the social media researcher at Cal Berkeley, these are cases of kids going out and seeking out this this experience, this adventure. It's not cases of abduction. I think we're misleading parents to suggest, if we do in any way, that this is about, that these sexual exploitation cases are about abduction. They're runaway cases. They're kids reaching out in a wrong way and seeking the wrong kind of support and sympathy and reinforcement.
In a sense, I absolutely agree with that. But we could also see the internet and technology as a force for good in this respect.
Absolutely.
As well. And I think we need to have the balance. And I dare to suggest that one very valid project might be to have an internet discourse with some of these children to discuss why it is that they are having these, why they feel the need to have these kind of relationships either in the virtual or the real world. And I just mentioned in that context, I mean, in terms of the positive that can come out, I'm doing some work with the industry and children's charities in the UK on a project called Kidspeak, which is children online talking about their experiences of domestic violence in the home, which links to self-harm and all the rest of it. And they are talking about what their experiences are together, which is a form of support, but it also shows that the technology can be used not just as a place where we imagine all sorts of nasty and horrible things are happening, but where children can inform each other, support each other, and inform us as policymakers, as guardians of their welfare, of the ways in which we can help them to develop socially and emotionally. So I think we need to make sure that we're using the technology in the positive way, as well as warning parents about the negative effects, because I think sometimes the fear factor overrides all, and the danger there is that somehow parents will see the web as a dangerous place for their children unless we agree we educate better, but that then children are driven into the kind of clandestine use of the technology in ways that we simply don't know about and can't anticipate because their brains are faster than theirs.
Which actually puts them at greater risk.
Exactly.
Right. So fear appeals as education. Does the fear appeal work? Because I've seen a lot of people talk about consumer education on child safety initiatives, and they're like, it's really a good campaign because it'll scare the pants off of everybody. And I don't. How do we parse that? Is that a good approach? Is that getting the attention and then the eyeballs that we need to communicate the message, or is it going? It will be misfiring.
I personally think it's somewhat misguided because there are so many wonderful things that children can do online and youngsters can do. I mean, in terms of interaction, for those of us who are little nerds living in rural areas of America growing up, we would have loved to probably had something like the internet to connect with unique, diverse populations or people or other kids out there we didn't know. So there are ways to connect. Of course, we have to also educate our kids about stranger danger. You know, the fact that we don't tell them, don't walk up to any stranger, just start talking in a shopping mall or a convenience store, you know. Be cautious about these things. You know, I liken it to, you know, going back to the Thornburgh Commission, the idea of training wheels and speed bumps approaches. You know, we can put some training wheels on the bikes, we can put some speed bumps in their way, but kids are still going to fall off bikes on occasion and they're still going to speed. So we have to go beyond that, talk about education and other things to help them out, to help them cope with these things. And then when there are serious harms or dangers, they need to be reporting them to authorities, school officials, or parents, hopefully first, to tell them what's going on. I also want to put in a big plug for what Microsoft is doing in companies like MySpace in terms of providing more monitoring tools. Because we're moving away from an era of just filtering everything out that's bad online to an era of monitoring what our kids are doing online, accepting that they're going to be interacting online. And there are wonderful monitoring tools on the market, both from sort of private box software vendors off the shelf and then being integrated in at the broadband or ISP level or by software providers, to provide parents with more tools to monitor what their kids are doing and then talk to them about it. Say, hey, I know you're visiting this site. Don't try to fool me. Let's talk about this. And that's a really important thing because we want to encourage a dialogue between parents and kids.
So with the question I'm really interested in is, how do we feel as a nation and parents and adults with regard to monitoring tools, monitoring what our kids are doing and how much we know about what they're doing, whether it's clandestine, spying, or whether we tell our children that we're going to monitor, install a monitoring tool and kind of see what they're doing. How do we? Is that a good way to go? Is there a double edge to the sword there?
I think what Chuck suggested earlier is the right approach. And David George, his colleague, when he was demoing the new Vista parental controls the other day, said that Microsoft is and I would really encourage other companies to consider this approach across the board, across all platforms and product lines, is pushing for education without fear and dialogue between parents and children. And I think monitoring is a good thing if it's done openly, not as spyware, because if something untoward happens, if a parent uncovers something scary or inappropriate, the parent has to talk to the child anyway. So you're in a position, you come into a more confrontational situation. There's a very practical reason for not allowing communication to break down on Web 2.0. It's unique and it's changing as the internet changes, and that is as Margaret mentioned earlier, there are so many workarounds. And believe me, if there's a workaround, a kid will find it. There are hundreds and hundreds of social sites, and the number is growing all the time. And kids will find them. They'll maintain a profile on MySpace that mom and dad will know about, and then they'll create a stealth profile. A really great cop youth officer in Connecticut tells parents this. You know, they will figure out a way to have their privacy because they're teenagers and they're getting a distance. So if you confront them, if you overreact, if you create an atmosphere of fear, they go underground. You know less about their experience, and they're at greater risk.
Margaret.
Well, yeah, I just want to caution I agree the point about openness is absolutely important, that the parents and children are talking about this if they are going to use some of this spyware or monitoring. But let me caution on the dangers, because we had a debate on this in the House of Commons. There are some parents that believe that some of the new tools that are being introduced onto mobile phones, into any of these devices which are able to track children, beware. One, you should know where your kids are if they're very young anyway, but nevertheless, those sorts of devices, tracking devices, can be used for all sorts of other things by all sorts of other people. Think of child abusers, of domestic violence cases. These things are not without other consequences, and I think we need to say to parents, this is not a quick fix solution to what is a very complex problem, and actually some of these things can be much more dangerous than we really understand.
Well, Ms. Moran, with regard to geolocation wireless tracking, certainly the UK is far ahead of the United States in that regard. So far, in fact, that we haven't even really started having discussions about geo-tracking. I think maybe if you come back and visit us next year, we probably are well within that debate. But it would be great to learn from your experience in that regard. So I'm running short on time. I'd like to go to the audience for questions. And I see Stephen Balcom has his hand up. Which a couple of interesting things with regard to teens before I go to the question is that I think one of those polling data we did with Zogby was asked audiences, if you could give up two of three things, what would they be? Television, radio, or internet? Older folks, generally, all the way up the scale, they would not give up television. 18 to 24-year-olds, they would kill before they let someone take away their internet. So I think that we're seeing a demographic shift. We didn't poll teens, of course, but I think we'd find the same thing. And I want to pose one other polling question we asked was, whose responsibility is it to protect our kids? And I'll give you the answer at the end of the panel. But Stephen?
Thanks, Tim. As this is the Neck Caucus conference, and we do have folks from the Hill here, I'd just be interested to ask the panel how you would grade this current Congress and this current administration. We have the COPA, the Child Online Protection Act, still grinding through the courts 8 years on. We have a mandatory labeling bill for sexually explicit material being brought back up to the fore. We have the idea of a porn tax being re-energized. How would you grade what this current administration, this current Congress is doing from A to F?
And keep in mind that this current Congress is 22 days old.
Well, I'll jump in on that one. First of all, Stephen Balcom, congratulations. He's got an important new organization forming now, the Family Online Safety Institute, and it's going to play an important role in this process. So I want to thank my friend Stephen for all his efforts in that regard. On Congress and the administration, I think the grade would be very low, C or a D, because it's all about regulation, not education or empowerment. It's all about finding ways to legislate or regulate our ways out of this problem without stopping to think, well, there might be other approaches that might bear more fruit over the long haul. And those, again, would go back to the educational things we've talked about and the parental empowerment things we've talked about, providing more tools, so on and so forth. We all can agree there is no one silver bullet solution to any of these issues. We need a layered approach to the problem. There's filters, there's monitoring tools, there's other types of efforts that can be taken by companies and trade associations. These are all good and well. Education is most important. These things are not being discussed in Congress, not generally being discussed within this administration. there's absolutely no dialogue about this as far as I can.
Let me go to Chuck, and then anybody else can be a critic.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in. I'm gonna disagree with Adam a little bit. For Microsoft, child online safety is so important. It's important as a part of our business that people and their families generally feel confident to go on the internet, to use computers and software and the great games on the Xbox and Xbox services. So that when lawmakers take an interest in this issue, it's actually very much appreciated by us, that they are thinking about ways in which they can help, that they are trying to come up with bills that are intended to improve child online safety. Now, in not every case, is that bill going to be absolutely perfect, but we are very much committed to working with all of the lawmakers to help craft the right approaches. And there are a couple of good ideas out there. Last session, Congresswoman Bean had a bill which I think talked about internet safety education and improving the federal approach of delivering that message out to the public, which sounds to us like a fantastic idea. As folks have mentioned, at the state level, attorney generals and governors have an opportunity to take a leadership role in bringing mandatory internet safety education to the curriculum in their state, using Virginia to some extent as a model approach. So I think there are opportunities here in this Congress, and we really look forward to working with the members.
And I want to go to Ms. Moran and then to Mark.
Well, it's not my role to be very
nice
of me to criticize anybody, and God knows we don't in the UK have any answers, except that I would say I'm kind of take a different approach to some of the others. I would say legislators, as I said right at the beginning, legislators need to push and cajole, but I don't think that you can just have legislation without having the cooperation. And what we have developed in the UK is some very good protocols and partnerships working together with the Internet Watch Foundation, with the Home Office Task Force, whereby politicians, industry and NGOs can work together. And I think unless you have that partnership that works through some of these complex issues, then you are not going to succeed by simply talking about legislation or regulation. You need to have that approach because industry, as you've said, has got a bottom-line interest. We've all got an interest in ensuring that we have confidence in the technology. Maybe it's a bottom-line interest, maybe it's a protection interest, but we have that common aim, and unless we have that foundation and those structures in place, no amount of legislation is going to make anything productive happen to protect our children or to improve the quality of life for our young people.
Mark?
Yeah, I think we're all in raging agreement on this. The idea of cajoling and otherwise discussing the issue with industry, I think, is very, very important. Last year, the Senate Banking Committee and the House Energy and Commerce Committee had hearings on what the financial services industry was doing in the area of child pornography, anti-child pornography efforts. Those are very useful efforts. They make sure that the industry continues its efforts, publicizes that we're on the case and that we're working in that area. I'm not sure we need legislation to mandate or require or put liability on people in that area, but I think the continuing interest by members of Congress in these problems and their continuing focus and attention to the problems is helpful to all of us and helps to build a kind of public-private partnership in this area.
Other questions? Take the microphone, please. If you may. Joan?
Hi. I'm Joan Irvine. I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Sites Advocating Child Protection. It is funded by the adult entertainment industry. One of the things we did not get to was preventing your children from looking at age-inappropriate content. One of the things we've been doing in the last couple of years is working with private sector and talking to people and saying the adult industry is buying for adults. We want to protect children. We've just introduced a label that is restricted to adults that we're hoping that people will be adopting both in the industry and that the parental control filtering systems will use. And we need to be working with everybody in order to have that adopted. We do find that sometimes people just go, adult entertainment, don't want to talk to us. We are private sector. We are trying to work with people to protect children. And anybody would like
and
to any kind
the
of
question,
initiative.
The question is, Joan?
If there are initiatives, how do we get to talk to people, since we represent this industry, that they will talk to us so we can help?
The question on the table is how do we have a dialogue if we're talking about public-private partnerships with the adult entertainment industry? How do we do this in the UK? How do we do this in the US? Is that something we should be doing?
I think there's a need for a dialogue. I mean, obviously, in terms of priorities, I mean, our priority is always going to be child abuse because that is criminal activity. And you start straying into, as I said earlier, we have to be clear about where we draw the line in terms of regulation or legislation. But I come back to the point that I made earlier. You have to have the structures in place for ongoing dialogue and for the development of agreed protocols around these things. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
The ICM registry that wanting to manage the .xxx domain had an interesting model. But again, .xxx is really only
And can you explain what that is, just really quickly?
It's a new top-level domain that would be basically a red light district for the internet, and it's the interesting model is this child safety foundation that ICM would support, and that itself would create dialogue and discussion ongoing with safety organizations, and I think that probably makes sense. But of course, it's only for the legitimate operators. There are a whole lot of porn sites out there that are not legitimate and would not participate. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest issue for parents, probably. It would be great if it could all be sequestered. But
before I go to Jules. Jules?
Tim, one quick suggestion. One of the reasons why that Zogby poll may have indicated that the older audience, the numbers were sort of inverse, and you had this audience that didn't want, that knew the sites better and maybe didn't want kids in, is also because that audience, 21-year-olds don't want to hang out with 14-year-olds and maybe have been eager to not have the teens.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
One other note, when we were kind of rolling out our parental controls version of here's how parents can...
And you're with AOL.
One of the challenges, my kids were really young at the time, and so I was like, oh, no big deal, I'll have that conversation, and sure, the kids will know. And as my kids got a little older, I'm like, I'm going to sit down and have a conversation with my daughter, who's, the tougher one in the family, and explain to her that I'm going to track her for this and this reason, as if I was going to explain to her that I go through her room every day and let's have a good conversation about that, but I'll be going through your room every day. As opposed to the responsible parent in the real life, where, okay, the door is open, no, I could go in, but I don't go in. And I never, I've been thinking, well, how am I ever going to have that conversation? Because I'll want to be responsible. And I think what dawned on me recently is I heard a woman explaining how she communicated to her child that they were adopted without having the big chat conversation. And she celebrated every single day of the child's life, not only a birthday, but, you're joining our family day. And it was always part of their consciousness. And so my conclusion is that even though my kids today, aren't connecting to the sitting on the computer, they're playing, age-appropriate games, they're 3 and 5, I got the thing on because I want them to have the expectation that, my parents have access to the computer, because otherwise I think it's a huge challenge. So the real quick question is, given that there's a big focus to push for age verification by those on the law enforcement side and elsewhere for, say, 16-year-olds, are any of the wise experts on our panel actually aware of any particular technology that any of those companies who even wanted to seek that option could use to reliably assure that a 16-year-old was 16?
The question is there a holy grail of age verification for child?
No.
I think the answer is no. Well, our technology folks have looked at this, and we work with a variety of partners in the Windows Vista ecosystem, mm-hmm. and I think they're looking at this too. There are basically two ways you might verify that age. One is you can collect the child's name and address and then ping that against a variety of databases to see whether there's a match and in that way verify it. Now, I think it's a question for the privacy and child safety experts collectively as to whether that's a good idea. Second way is you could have a authenticated entity make verifiable age claims about that child. And then there's technology in the Windows platform called CardSpace that enables you to make identity claims in a very secure and structured way. But we have to figure out who that verified source of the age claim would be, how you secure that in, on an end-to-end basis, and then who that is offered to and how they make use of it. So there are a number of very important privacy and safety questions about age verification. And we look forward to having conversations with the law enforcement and political folks who are interested in this, but we really need to think through those questions before we get much down the road of requiring anything.
Yeah, from the point of view of Visa, we don't know of any age verification software or technology that's out there. Certainly using the payment card itself is not an indicator that you're dealing with an adult. So we really do rely on the presence of other kinds of technology to deal with that issue, and we don't know of any good ones out there.
Well, thank you, Jules. On that, we have our lunch starting, so I don't want to get in the way of that. It'll be in the main ballroom. And I know you've been in suspense about what the polling data said with regard to who should protect our children. We gave people four options. One was internet service providers, one was websites, one was law enforcement, one was parents. It was really an unfair question. It pulled up the charts. 90% said parents. But I think we've heard today that is probably the case, but there's a shared responsibility and everybody's working in that regard. So I really want to thank our guests from the UK and the rest of the panel. Thank you.